Good evening. Welcome once again. Happy New Year. And tonight, pleased to welcome Claudia Walter from the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute, who's been working on genome statistics, in summary, for several years. And, it's about rare variant analysis. So if any of you are a bit peculiar, this will be relevant to you. One last little thing. Some of you may not have paid your year's subscription of £1. This will duly be gathered up, but I guess if you fail, then Claudia will somewhat painfully take a DNA sample. Anyway, over to you, Claudia. Thank you.
Yes, so thanks for inviting me. I will mainly convince you or tell you how much data has been and how much work. I will take you sort of through the project, touching on some things more than other things, but I'll try to give you an overview and I will try to tell you how much data it's been. So it's called UK10K Cohorts Project. So the UK10K project is 10,000 samples of the UK, but I'll be looking only at 3,621. So I will give an introduction, tell you what the data looks like, and then we did a lot of QC, quality control of site and samples. And then I will only briefly mention the association tests, although this was actually the core thing about the whole study. And then I will talk a bit more about population stratification. So first, I know it's sort of very mixed audience. I will try to explain briefly what is a DNA sequence and why do we even want to do sequencing and compare exome and low coverage whole genome sequencing. And then I will talk about the structure and the aims of the UK10K project. Okay, so the human genome consists of 46 chromosomes. So this is 22 autosomal pairs, one from the father, one from the mother. And then if you're female, you have 2X. If you're male, you have an X and Y. Each chromosome has a structure of this double helix, where you have the sugar phosphate backbone on the outside. And the nucleotides, they link the two together, the two backbones. So and you always have adenine pairing with thymine. So A and T always link together with two hot hydrogen bonds. And guanine and cytosine, so G and C always link together with three hydrogen bonds. So that's from their structure, they can't pair otherwise. They can only pair A with T and C with G. So that's about it. I mean, the sequence, when we talk about DNA sequence data, it just means a long string of A, C, G's and T's. And there are many of them. The chromosome one is 250 million base pairs. So this is a base pair, one base pair, nucleotide pair. And the smallest one is about 50 million base pairs. So in total, the human genome is over 3 billion base pairs. So it's just a lot. So why do we want to do sequencing? So we are interested in the DNA sequence contains the genetic code, your genetic makeup. And in this study, we're interested in linking it to various phenotypes to see whether we find a signal that's related to height that can predict how tall you are, that can predict how much you will weigh, your glucose levels, blood lipids, things like that. So we want to link genotypes with phenotypes. And this has been done many times before. Mostly at the beginning, there was sort of microarray chip data, but with those you can only get sort of common variants. What I forgot to say, why are we interested? The human genome exists, the reference genome exists since 2000, the rough draft. But the point is, one person to the next varies, there's a difference of 0.1% between two human genomes. In comparison, the difference to chimpanzees is 4%. So if we have just one reference genome, that's not enough, because we want to know the variation. We want to know how people differ in their genetic makeup. So, and this has been done, but only for variants that are sort of common in the population, where maybe 10% of the population has a variant that's different from the other 90%. But we want to go much lower. We want to know variants that occur only 1% in the population and compare that to the 99% or even lower. We want to go as low as possible. And this can be only done with sequencing, because even with the 1000 Genomes Project, which has now 1,000, well, the current release that's been worked on is 2,500 samples. The previous one that was published is 1,000 samples. And even that is not enough. Even when you try to impute using this resource, you can't get to very low frequencies. And there is evidence that rare variants do associate with disease, but the effect will be probably very low. I mean, the hope was that you find rare variants that have a large effect, but they have already been found. Rare variants that have a large effect, common variants that have little effect is also easy to find, but there's a bandwidth in the middle which is really hard to detect. And now with sequencing, you have two options. You either just sequence the exome, that's just the coding part, this is just the genes, but it's only 1.5% of the whole genome. Or you do the whole lot. And this is to show the power to detect SNPs. This is from the 1000 Genomes Project paper. From 0.5% minor allele frequency or 10, when you see 10 non-reference alleles, there is almost no difference. When you go further down, then whole genome drops down, because with low genome, it's so-called low coverage. I will explain that later. So you get less information per site than you will get with the exome data, because it's just too expensive. And here this other panel shows the sort of the accuracy. And accuracy is good for more common ones, and then sort of it drops off as well for rarer ones. With and without LD, that means liquid disequilibrium, and this is because you can, the genome, some blocks are conserved, so if you take that into consideration, that the conservation between blocks, you can get the higher accuracy. So please interrupt me if you have questions. Okay, so now about the 1000 Genomes Project. This was a 10.4 million pound grant by the Wellcome Trust. 164 researchers from 51 institutions. And in total we have, or we were aiming for, 10,000 samples, mostly from the UK, but a few from Finland, because they are well-studied population. And the goals were to look at the rare and low frequency variants, to do association studies of the sequenced samples, and to provide a resource for the community, the sequence data as well as the phenotype data. So the project was subdivided into two main parts. So 6,000 samples were whole exome sequenced and 50x depth. That means each base, each side of the genome had on average 50 reads covering the base. I will explain that better later. Whereas, so you get much more information for each site than you get for a whole genome sequencing, where it's only 6x depth. But here, the idea is that you impute across many samples, that you fill in missing bits and low quality bits. So, I mean, this would be at the moment too expensive to do really deep. And here you have more information. But as I tried to show at the previous slide, that actually for more common variants, you have almost the same information. The exome sequencing part, it was sort of the disease part. We had 3,000 cases for autism and schizophrenia, 2,000 obesity, 1,000 rare diseases, and these are various rare diseases, glaucoma, severe insulin resistance. But I won't be talking about this one. I will be talking about the 4,000 cohort samples project, where we had two different cohorts. One is Twins UK, based at King's College London, and the twin samples come from all over the UK. The color code shows you where they're coming from, so most of them come from London, also they're around London, but we have Scottish samples and samples from Northern Ireland as well. The other, and these are sort of all females, median age 46, so they come from all over the UK. Whereas ALSPAC is the even longitudinal study of parents and children, and they all come from the Bristol area. And this is a birth cohort, so the mothers were recruited in the beginning of the 90s. So they were when the data was collected for this study, they were about 18 years of age. So these two cohorts have the advantage that we have a lot of phenotypic data.
Your percentages, according to the colors here, they represent percentages of what?
Number of samples, number of people. Where they... So,
So over 100% in the blue spot, but 100% of what?
Sorry. The ALSPAC samples, they come all from Bristol.
Okay. So that is percentage of
the
sample, which is ALSPAC.
Within the cohort.
Okay,
so
thank you.
Cohort. So the ALSPAC, they come exclusively from Bristol, and Twins UK come from everywhere.
Right.
And I mean, Scottish samples, that's just one, two samples per region or county. So I guess because they had to travel to London, they have to travel to London, to King's College, ever so often, so it's more likely if they live close to London that they will come. And also, of course, it's more densely populated.
Two cohorts, basically, covered the whole cohort sample.
Yes, so the aim was to get 2,000 samples from twins and 2,000 samples from ALSPAC. So that's with how many we started. Yeah.
What's the difference between the exome sequencing and the whole genome sequencing?
Between
the exome sequencing.
There are differences, and I haven't got this slide. So very rare variants. You get better with exome sequencing if it's very rare, but you get with whole genome sequencing and low coverage, you get down pretty well, not just quite as much as exome sequencing. So you, with exome sequencing, you discover more singletons, variants that appear only once in 3,000-4,000 samples.
Is the exome more expensive?
Well, the exome is only 1.5% of the whole.
So does that mean it's easier or
gene?
Different?
That's cheaper because it's less right. Data that you need to generate. So it's cheaper. Exome sequencing is cheaper because it's just less of the genome.
Exome, are you looking at particular sites of the genome?
Yeah, so exome, yeah, you just look at the protein coding genes at the
so what's the advantage of doing the whole genome? So why do the whole genome?
Sorry. Well, there are regulatory bits that are not in the exons of the genes, which will have an effect on the gene regulation.
We might find something.
And we might find something. That's the hope. Sorry. Was it the same question?
I think the exons are the extreme of the gene, a small bit.
So, yeah, the exons are just a small bit. Even within a gene, you might have a large genetic region, but you have only some bits in the exons are sort of just.
I think that they are sequences of 22 letters or something like that in the human.
Also, the amino acids?
The exons. The sequences of 22 letters approximately.
Also, yeah, the amino acids. In total, we have 20,000 genes. And this is just 1%, 1.5% of the whole genome. Yeah?
Have you selected only the coding sequence or do you have no coding sequence?
I haven't worked on the exome data at all. They did this capture array. There is possibly, I mean, when we did sort of with our data, we did an analysis just of the exome part, and then first I took protein coding genes, then we missed out some bits, and then I took also non-coding genes, and it's sort of a much wider range, like 36,000 genes, so not just protein coding genes for our analysis.
Because they're quite interesting for the
Yes. But sorry, I don't know much about the exome part of the project, so you will get the whole genome. Okay, so yeah, let's have a look what the data actually looks like. Here we have again the double helix, and this is been broken into pieces by sonication, for example. And then they select fragments that have roughly the same length. So they are between 200 and 400 base pairs, for example. So you have this long, long string of DNA, and then you fragment it, and you take the pieces that are between 200 and 500 base pairs long. And then this bit is only this bit is sequenced. Only the ends, rather. So the adapter ligated and I don't know the particulars of that part, but they come into a flow cell and they are in clusters. When you look at the flow cell, there are sort of lots of dots. It's lots of clusters, and each cluster has sort of the same DNA. And then it's only the end. So this is the whole. String, the 200 base pair string, but only this bit is sequenced. Only the end bits are sequenced. One end, and then the other end. And then these ends are being mapped against the reference genome. So that's already a whole area of work with people writing software. So you have all these pieces, this is one piece now, a 200 base pair piece, but you've only sequenced the red bits. But you know how they belong together, so you know they're roughly 200 base pairs apart, bases apart. So you know when one end maps, the other maps somewhere in that region. So that's already that introduces already a lot of uncertainty, because the human genome is very repetitive, and even if one end sort of maps very well, you might not find, or it might map, even if you find a good mapping for both ends, it might map to many different places in the genome. And this is, these are all these fragments that are mapped back. So here's, it's just, at the beginning it was just 35 bases long, the bits that were actually sequenced. Now it's 100 bases, which is better for mapping back to the reference genome.
Just a question here. So let's take the segment in the top left-hand corner there, that one ends. Let us say that the left-hand end, you match that against the reference genome, mm-hmm. and that is in fact the right position for that mm-hmm. segment, but the right-hand end does not match because it's a mutation.
Yes, also there are sequencing errors.
Yeah. Okay.
It's very low frequency, but you have also sequencing errors. Yes, you're right. You have to allow for mismatches.
Mm.
You can't always assume it's a perfect match. You have to allow for mismatches, which makes it even harder. And the mismatch can be an error, or it can be a true variant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can actually have ambiguity as to whether you have matched it correctly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But if you have many of them, and that is what's called coverage or sequence depth. That's why you want to sequence many, many, many fragments and map them all against the reference genome, and then you have lots of evidence at any one position. And that's why it's better to have, if you are just interested in the exome, then it's better to just do exome sequencing to a really high depth, because that will increase the evidence. But if you want to sequence the whole genome, that's expensive, then you can only do low coverage, but then you can do many samples, and that's how you build up your coverage, through many samples. Because imagine, we had to start with 4,000 people, each sequenced that at 6x, so every position was covered on average of 24,000 times. So we had 24,000 of these reads at each position.
Seems a bit strange to chop it up and then try to put it back together. Why didn't you just string it out?
Yeah, good point. And there are many companies who try exactly that, but it
right.
seems to be hard.
Oh, really? You chop it up, mix it all up, and then try to put it, it's like doing a jigsaw.
It is actually interesting, because when I first started working on this data, it was 2007, and it seemed 2008, I went to a conference where PacBio introduced their way of sequencing, and it looked like it would be easy. And at that point I thought already, why do we invest so much effort with this, because in no time we will have something that spits out long sequences. Yeah. And now it's how many years later and it still hasn't happened. Yes. Yeah. But people are working on it, so there's Oxford Nanopores, for example, a company. So there are several companies, but it seems to be hard. But at some point it will be possible. But yeah, anyway, so this is the data, so this is when I talk about depth or coverage and so, and then we have a long production pipeline. So this mapping bit, there are lots of different mapping softwares. We have been using BWA, which is a Boros-Wheeler transform thing. And then we get the data format called BAM format, and then another software, SandTools, does this variant calling, so it looks at each position and looks whether they all match to the reference genome, or whether there's a base or several bases that are different. That spits out another format, VCF format. And then after that we did we spent a lot of time, months and months and months, on quality control of sites and samples. And then there's another step called genotype refinement, where you fill in missing data or low quality data because of the low coverage. You might have evidence for a variant, but then you don't know which of the samples really have the variant, because you might, some samples might not have enough reads at that position. So this is also a necessary step, and then we do another round of quality control. So, I mean, this project was officially finished end of September 2013, but we're still working on writing it up. So this is the BAM format, just to give you a quick idea. So it tells you the chromosome and the position where it maps. It gives you a quality measure. It gives you the actual sequence. So this is the actual sequence that was sequenced. And it gives you some other information, whether it was mapped as a proper pair or not. So this is the first data format. The next one is the VCF format. It gives you again a sort of chromosome position, then this RSID, that's dbSNP, so each SNP has an ID. It tells you what the reference genome is at this position, and it tells you what your read. So this is a SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism, just one base change, and the one below is an insertion. So you get this piece of string instead of a T. So that can also happen. You can have small or larger insertions or deletions, not just single base pair changes, which is even harder. Then you get, so here for example, 18,000 is the depth. So you had 18,000 reads that sort of are used as evidence for this SNP. It tells you how many alleles. So for each person you have two alleles, so number of people times two. And then the allele count. So 21 alleles were different from 4,864. And then it gives you other, like Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, inbreeding coefficient. So you get lots of other information that you can use for quality control. And then it tells you for each sample, it tells you whether it's a homozygous reference, so it does not have the variant, or whether it's heterozygous, whether it has one copy like the reference and one copy like the variant. So this is the data. So we had three releases, the last one a year ago. So we started with 3,900 samples. We started with 4,000, over 4,000 samples, but then a few were dropped out right at the beginning, then 3,900 were sequenced, and then after data QC we were left 3,781 samples, 1,800 from twins, 1,900 from Allspark. We have 42 million variants, 3 million indels, which are short insertions or deletions, and 18,000 large deletions, so greater than 200 base pair, between 200 base pair and 100,000, 100 megabase pairs, 100 million. SNPs per sample, so each sample has 3 million SNPs, where it differs for some out, and singletons per sample, 5,000. So SNPs that only were found in that one sample. So every person has 5,000 single nucleotide polymorphisms that maybe no other person has, at least in a cohort of a few thousand people. And the data size, so this is compressed 660 gigabytes of data. So uncompressed, it's then well over terabyte.
Are these numbers now kind of converging? So based on the coverage you have and the file or the quality, so 3 million SNPs per person is kind of converging.
good question. I mean, well, it depends on the population. African samples are more different, so they have a greater variety, so they will have a higher number of singletons. I mean, yeah.
Because I remember it was like 4 years ago, it was part of that.
Okay, yeah. It's when you look at the data, it seems always to be half of the data is singletons. and yeah. So, I mean, yeah, this is a lot of data. And anything you do just takes a long time. Just when you want to have a quick look at something, it will take hours just to extract anything.
Don't you have fast computers?
Well, I mean, we have a huge computing farm with thousands of machines, and there are ways like indexing the file, so that goes quick. So there are ways that people have developed in indexing, and then it goes like, yeah, very quick. Okay, so let's start with the quality control of sites. This took a long time and we looked at many things. You can look at read depth, Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. Then, luckily, the Broad Institute developed a method called variant quality score recalibration, which combined several measures. Then we looked at which sites are shared with Thousand Genomes Project, minor allele frequency bias, and various batch effects. You always get batch effects.
What's a site?
A variant, a base pair, okay. A position. A position in the genome.
Right.
Yeah, site is a position. So this is chromosome 20, the length of chromosome 20. This is the centromere, which is sort of very repetitive and not really sequenced, unfinished. Very repetitive, and you get this high number of reads around, because this is also repetitive sequence around the centromere. So this is bad. If you have lots and lots of reads piling up at one position, then you know there's something wrong. So you want to get rid of those, and also at the telomeres at the ends. There's also, and this is also a repetitive problem. So you don't want that. You want sort of an even depth across all the chromosomes, across genomes. So this is a problem. And then this coincides, is at the same sites where the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium is very low, or not like expected. So you can do a chi-square test. So Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium means you expect sort of the same proportion from one generation to the next, sort of people, of alleles who are like the reference, heterozygous, or like the alternative. And you can do, you have an expectation what it should be like, and you can test it against what you observe, and you get a p-value, and the ones where, so this is Hardy-Weinberg, value minus log 10 here. So you don't want those sites either, because that means there's something not quite right. So these sites you want to filter out, and luckily, as I said, we are using this VQSR. That's sort of a machine learning approach. It uses Gaussian mixture models and the training set of sites where people know these are two sites, and then you can calibrate each variant and feed several measures like depth and mapping quality. You can feed in several measures into this approach, and you get out one probability, or one score rather, a single score from several measures. And you can use that as an overall quality score for this site. And we did use that as a first filter. Yeah, and it comes from the Broad Institute. And this is what the curve looked like. So we had these two curves, so these were known. So this is TSTV ratio. And you want to have that around 2 or so. It's actually a bit too high here. But you don't want it very low. Very low is bad. So, and known sites are usually better than novel sites. And so you want to choose a cutoff, which is sort of a balance between false positives and false negatives. So you want to capture as many sites, but you don't want false sites. And that's what we got sort of in the first step. So that's what I showed you earlier. And all the ones that are red, we got rid of with this VQS cutoff. So after using this score, we got rid of all the sites, and the blue sites were left over. I mean, still a few that we probably don't want. Another way you can look at how it compares to the Thousand Genomes Project. So here's minor link frequency. So 10% of your samples have the variant. And this is already sort of a common site. So for 10% minor allele frequency from the Yucatenki, this is 75 alleles. For those, it's already quite, you find the same site in the Thousand Genomes Project. So the if it's a common site, you should find it already in another big data set. And if not, then there's a problem with the site. And of course, this drops for lower minor allele frequencies. But you can use it sort of as a quality control. This is just to show what the percentage for each chromosome, the percentage of sites that are easily accessible with this method of just sequencing the ends of each fragment. I said repetitive regions are difficult, and we have about 30%, so this is the percentage of sites that are not so easily accessible, that these are very repetitive. Whereas 70% are sort of well behaved. This is to show what happens with the genotype refinement. I said we need to do this step because we have low coverage and we want to fill in missing and low quality genotypes. And this is before the genotype refinement. So, which way around? This is the concordance. So it's not right up here. And this is the number, this for different for homozygous reference, people who have genotypes which are just like the reference. This the orange one is heterozygous, where you have a copy each, a copy of the reference, a copy of the variant. And homozygous alternative means you have two copies of the variant. So and the numbers are sort of relatively low, but after this genotype refinement step, this gets up higher. Here you're almost at 1. So the concordance is very good with external data that you can compare to, sort of chip genotypes. So I mean, this is just to show that this imputation step is sort of necessary to fill in missing and low quality genotypes to get your better data set. Yeah, this is another minor allele frequency bias. You can compare the frequencies of the variants from your data set with Thousand Genomes, and when it's very different, then that doesn't look good either. And then we had batch effect that we discovered quite late, because some samples were sequenced in Kingston at the Wellcome Trust at the Sang Institute, and some were sequenced at BGI in Beijing. And you always, when it's sequenced at different places, it's always different or over time. So these were sequenced over a long period of time. You get differences. So yeah, so this is the difference. So this is Sanger sequenced, Alsberg, BGI sequenced of the Alsberg sample, Sanger sequence of twins, BGI sequenced of the twins. So here the BGI samples, they look actually better because they're sort of, I mean, the cohort difference didn't matter because we analyzed them separate. So the cohorts that were not a problem, but this one between Sanger and BGI, that was
concerned.
Oh, sorry. This is a principal components analysis. The first principal component against the second one of the genotypes, or sort of the each one is a sample, each dot is a sample. So, yes. Yes.
And that would be unacceptable in any quality control
yes.
process for anything.
Yes, so we've then, I mean, these are sites that are difficult to sequence mainly, so and after taking them out, then it looks much better afterwards. So you can, you can. We can fiddle.
Just take away a center effect.
Sorry.
Can
you tell the places this type of sequencing?
Yes, they do. It's both Illumina sequences. But even over time, I mean, this is by time here, sequenced over different. I mean, the protocol changes. There are various things that change over time, and everything has sort of an effect. But we got it. I don't have the plot what it looks now, but it did look much better.
After you took out the
film. I have it on my laptop actually.
Very honest.
And I mean, I mean this just shows that these sites where these differences occur, they are, so this is again sort of a centromeric region. It's around repetitive region often. So it's where it's sort of ambivalent, where it's not quite clear. The mapping was also done at PGI, I think. They gave us then the... So that's another thing. So there, it's a long pipeline, and each step there are uncertainties.
It is strange that in these less well-defined regions, we still have a consistent bias, like one center against the other. This is strange, isn't it?
You expect...
I mean, yes, fair enough. These positions are not well defined, right? So repetitive regions and stuff, but
yeah,
why do you
yeah.
systematically the same genotype in these sort of repetitive regions in one center versus the other? So why is there a systematic bias in this less well? Is this true?
You can imagine like reagents getting all the company different batches and concentrations.
Yes, so I mean, for example, so the VGI, so these were all sequenced together, I think, within a short period of time, so these samples and these samples. And at the summer, they were sequenced over long...
But why should sequencing together,
well, reagents, for example.
Yeah, but why should that induce an A in a particular position in all the samples?
So for example, we had one problem with this flow cell. There were bubbles on the flow cell, and that introduced them insertions. You had them suddenly, yeah. I mean, there are lots of technical artifacts that you can get.
It looks like if you saw this slide, definitely Sander should stop working on this.
But I mean, for example, this one. This one was sequenced in a short period of time, and this is well together. All the green ones, they were all done in July.
Well,
so
this is summer, and then it got winter. Things just changed.
Yeah, I don't know. So, we did then also comparison with exome data. And then we had quality controls of samples. And this is the flow chart. So what I said before, we started with close, well, here we had more than 2,000 samples. So more than 4,000 in total. Then some didn't make it even to the sequencing step. They were filtered out before for various reasons. And then, there was sort of basically, I think it's contamination, which gives a problem. And then you have to remove those. Then we did genotype refinement step, we had this number, and then another. Then of course you get more genotypes, and then a few more contaminated samples pop up, and this is what we then had as a final release. But then in the twin samples we had all these related twins, and we wanted an unrelated set. And then we removed a few more samples, and that's the number we used for association analysis. Yeah, so for the sample QC, this is heterozygous rate for each sample versus discordance rate. And discordance rate, we compared the sequence sample to some chip data that we had, sort of independent data, so we could compare that. And this sort of correlated nicely with the heterozygous rate, correlated nicely with the discordance rate. So if you did not have an external data source you can compare it to, you can still use high heterozygous rate as a filter, as a data quality control measure. And then here was one sample that had a really low heterozygous rate. This was also sort of suspicious. This was just done on chromosome 20. And then I had a closer look at chromosome 20. So this is again chromosome 20. You have here the centromere. And the red is the heterozygous rate that suddenly dropped off. And you have these long runs of homozygosity, which is sort of unusual because it means basically your parents are related. You have the same. So this is the most likely explanation in that case. There could be other reasons, but this is, in that case, probably the most likely explanation, that the parents were sort of distant cousins. And then for a stretch, you inherit from both parents sort of the same stretch. Because I was also looking at, this is read depth, I was looking whether this could be a really large deletion, but this is not the case because here the depth is sort of the number of reads that map to the region that's the sort of fairly the same apart from the centrum, yeah. So this was interesting to us.
Any geographical association with that phenomenon?
we come to population stratification. This is number of singleton samples, so if that is too high, it also points that it's probably non-European in that case. There are more variants that are not shared with other populations, so that's another, if you want sort of European ones, then you can throw those out. Okay, now this, and then after we did all this QC and sample QC, site QC, which took us months and years, we did association analysis. So that means first a single point analysis. So you analyze each site separate, so there were sort of several millions of sites. And basically it's like a linear model. You look whether your trait is correlated with sort of whether your homozygous reference samples are lower in glucose than your heterozygous samples, and whether those are lower than your homozygous alternative samples. So you can do that for each single site, but this doesn't work well if it's very rare, so you need a certain number of samples to do this. And then you get sort of hits, and this is one that's been published before. So this is the log minus log 10 of the p-value. So these are various genes here. This is chromosome stretch on chromosome 2. And then you get this one site. No, not this one site. There are actually several sites, but this one locus, where you get this association between your genotype and glucose levels. And I think we were hoping, or the idea was we would get many, many more with sequencing. But actually, the ones that pop up, they've been found before with chip data because they're easy to find, and the other ones are just hard to find. So the other thing we did was a rare variance analysis where you combine, so you don't have enough power for each single site because it's so rare. So the idea is you do sort of a burden test, you combine several rares, variants, and think, well, maybe the lot together will have an effect. And we did sort of two things. So one was just the exomes, the protein coding genes, or rather, 26,000 genes. And a gene looks like you have an untranslated region at the beginning, then you have your first exon, then you have maybe some regulatory things. But we look just at the UTR and the exons. We lumped them all together. So we analyzed each gene in one go. And if there were more than 50 variants, we split it into smaller windows. So we had 41,000 windows that we tested. But it's sort of arbitrary, sort of the variance analysis with software called SCUF can do a certain number of SNPs, but not too many. And the other one was genome-wide, so we tiled in 3 kilobase, so 3,000 base pair windows, which overlapped by half, and on average there were 35 variants per window. So we use these two approaches. And we're sort of still in the process of analyzing that, so it's not quite finished. Okay, and this was actually the main part I wanted to get on to, population genetics. So there was this paper by Gil McQueen, Ian Matheson in Nature Genetics, and they claimed, so normally when you do an association study, you have to control for all sorts of things. For example, for population structure, so that you don't get false positive hits. And they were claiming in their paper that for rare variants, it wouldn't be possible to use the same methods like principal components analysis, like for common variants. And there would be a strong effect, but it wouldn't be possible to correct for it easily. But all their analysis was based on simulated data. So we had a look at our data. We had for the twins, we had for 1,100 twins, we had the place of birth, and I converted that into longitude and latitude sort of geographical coordinates. And we looked at 50 phenotypes that were adjusted for age, sex, and sometimes for other instrument effects. And I used generalized additive models by Trevor Hasty and Robert Cipriani. And that's sort of an extension of a traditional linear statistical model, sort of very versatile. You can use continuous data, categorical data. And it uses a scatterplot smoothing function. The only problem, it could overfit the data. That's what it looks like. So you have a model specifies a distribution, such as normal, binomial. You have a link function. And then you have here, instead of a linear model, you have all these functions, and that can be anything. So you can fit sort of a scatter plot smoother. And they did that for all the traits, and sort of for each trait against geographic location, and then we tested the significance of the smoothing functions with ANOVA. And that's what you get. So urea, glucose, height, leptin were sort of the more significant ones. Further down we have blood pressure, very low LDL, triglycerides, LDL, BMI. And after you correct sort of for multiple testing with false discovery rate, then it's only those sort of, these are different preparations, phenotype preparations, where we calculated the residuals. So it's basically four traits that came up in that analysis: urea, glucose, height, and leptin. And so this is what the residualized data looks like. So you have, for leptin, you have lower ones. This is lower in the south and higher in the north. And for height, it's higher in the south, lower in the north. I think this is sort of well known, sort of a north. No, it's north-south effect with height. So you get sort of a bit of an effect, and you can correct for that with the GAM models. I mean, here actually it fits sort of a wavy thing, so it's low here, gets higher, low here again, and for height it's sort of just sort of north-south. But it's sort of a very low effect compared to the original data.
So
the
south
border. Yes. I'm just wondering whether that was the right way round. So and for glucose, yeah, there's some lower patches, this is higher up. Urea is also lower in the south. The test the kidney function, and when it's higher that's bad. So lower in the south is better. And you can again correct with fit the GAM model. That sort of models that nicely. And then because we didn't well, don't eat this deep fried Mars bars. And then we were not quite sure what to make of the significance of the smoothing function of the ANOVA, and so we tried to fit randomized traits. So we generated randomized traits, small distribution, zero mean, one standard deviation, and we added a regional spike somewhere around York, I believe it was, and the north-south cline, so high in the north, lower in the south. So I generated this random trait, and then I just added on sort of different spikes and different clines in different combinations. And that's what we got. So I used about 1,500 samples with different combinations, generated 1,000 traits, fitted GAM models, and then this is the observed. These were the observed p-values we got from our traits. And these are sort of 95% confidence intervals for if there is nothing, no spike, no cline, no cline, a bit of a spike, a bit of a cline, a bit of a spike, a bit more. The spike doesn't seem to have as much as an effect as the cline here. So we have here this all clines once. This is the largest sort of north-south cline. This has sort of a larger effect than sort of a local spike. But we are probably, there is probably a bit of effect, an effect, but maybe not too strong. And this comes back to the, so this was all phenotype data, and this comes back to the genotype data. So this is taken from the paper from Mattison and McVean, where they said, okay, they did this simulated data, and then they said, okay, for common variants, this is the green line, we don't see much of an effect. If the variant is a bit of lower frequency, we see more of an effect with distance, meaning people who live close together will share more genotypes than people who live far apart. Sort of for common traits, it doesn't, for common genotypes, it doesn't matter because sort of that's sort of more distributed, so people will share common variants. But rare variants, people who live locally will share more than, and it drops off much, much faster for really rare variants. And they did that a migration rate. So this is about FSD, this is about for sort of worldwide, I assume, yeah, I think that this was sort of worldwide, and this is sort of on a European scale. But you would still see this effect for rare variants, this drop, meaning that people who live locally share are more likely to share. Okay, so we implemented the method and looked in our data, and we didn't see anything. But then we thought we need to go lower. So this is 1% minor allele frequency, which is still 75 alleles or so. Right. And then we looked sort of really, really low allele count, 2. So a variant that appears just twice in the whole cohort of 3,500 samples. And then looked at sort of just at those variants and then how many of these are shared between two people. So we have 1,100 samples. And then for each sample pair, I looked how many of those really rares are shared. And then most people don't share anything of this really rare, because I mean, yeah, it appears only, it's rare. But then you have some people who share a lot. And this does drop off with distance. When you correct for the number of pairs. So you have an expectation, if you have 10 samples in one county and 20 samples in another county, how many possible pairings can you get between the counties? And how many do you observe? And so I repeated sort of the analysis that we did before. And then you can see sort of allele count 2 is the most extreme one because it's the most rare case. Whereas allele count 7 is already flatter. So you can see how this sort of drops sort of, so you can see, so again, this means the same thing, distance, alleles shared. So people who live close together are more likely to share rare alleles than people who live far apart. But the effect sort of gets weaker when the allele count gets higher, sort of how many genotypes you observe. So I did this sort of overall, sort of just Euclidean distance between the twins, 1,139 twins, and then another distance to Bristol without London, but it's sort of the same effect, and these are the Bristol samples. So that was sort of another check. Okay, and then we looked at larger sort of regions, how many. So again, I had the same 1,139 twins from Twins UK. I know the phenotype and place of birth. I counted again how many shared doubletons for allele count 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 7 between each pair. And I can summarize that within the region and between the regions, and then I can correct for the number of pairs within the region and between the regions. And then we get something like that. So we have 12 regions here and the same 12 regions here. If it's dark, there is not much shared. If it's very light, there's a lot shared. So the diagonal will be higher because, well, it appears within a region people share more than between regions. But again, we have this very long tail, so we have lots of samples that don't share much, and the few samples who share a lot. So you have this long, long tail. And I mean, I tried to split it up so that I split out this bit, so it's actually a bit exaggerated. Because if you split the data here, 1, 1.5, 2.5, you don't see anything really, because there's just it would be just one color. But if you try to separate out sort of subtle effects of subtle differences, then you get this pattern. So Wales, Scotland and Northern region, they are sort of more similar within the county than southwest, eastern and so on. So this is more related, so the Welsh people are more related to each other than people in London. And then the interest...
You haven't got Norfolk there, have you?
Well, we've got
we've got Eastern, which is pretty bright yellow.
Eastern is less related to Wales, Scotland than to Northern or. And the interesting thing is between the regions, so you don't get so much relationship between the region apart from Scotland with Northern Ireland. So that's the strongest one between the counties. And then the next one is Northern and Northern Ireland. And now watch the pattern if I click through. So it's fairly dark. And then this is allele count 3, allele count 4, allele count 5, 6, 7. It gets lighter and lighter. So the allele count, so the more common the variant, the higher the sharing between the counties. Here the lowest is between Northern Ireland and Wales. Mm. Although that's a bit well, I don't know. And then we did the same thing. Oh, okay, you have a cluster plot. So the Welsh are sort of apart from everyone. And then you have. I'm not quite convinced about this hierarchical clustering because Northern Ireland is suddenly down here. But you have London, Southern London, North, South, East, you have together. North, Midland, Eastern. Yeah. Well. Then you can do the same on a county level. So it's the same thing on a county level. And then you get this cluster. So again, the lighter the color, the more related. So here are sort of Scottish ones. Here you have Northern Irish ones, again sort of patches, Northern Ireland with Scotland. So here's Scotland and here Northern Ireland, here's Scotland and here's Northern Ireland. So it's the same order, of course. Where's Norfolk?
Here's
there you go. Oh yeah.
Here's Norfolk.
Where is it?
Big square.
Quite dark. And again, watch the colors when we go through. So this is fairly dark. We have allele count 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and it gets lighter. So, yeah. And one scatter plot. So here we have. I don't know why the Isle of Wight is here, but the other ones are Northern Ireland here.
Yeah.
And here we have Scotland. So I mean, okay, for some counties we have very, very few samples, so it's probably quite noisy to look at the county level. So, altogether, it's meant to be a resource for the community, the genotype data as well as the phenotype data. At the moment, or maybe in the future, you need to sort of sign a data access agreement to be able to access the data. But I mean, in principle, it's not a problem. It's just, it's not sort of public like the Thousand Genomes Project because it involves genotype and phenotype data. But it is accessible and it's submitted to the European Genome Archive. And yeah, it's genotype and phenotype. So I just wanted to give you an overview, tell you how much data it's been, how much work it's been, and in future there will be more data. So that the NHS, as far as I know, they have agreed to sequence 100,000 samples. But this will be spread over many years, I guess, and different centers, and will be sort of, I guess, disease cases. And it's been a lot of time is needed for the quality control. There are a lot of people involved. So Richard Durbin is the chair. This is my boss, Nicole Soranzo. Nicholas Timson from Bristol, he's the other co-chair for the cohorts project. Then lots of people, production and the different exome groups and other people from Sanger. And this is a more complete list of the cohorts team. So from many based at the Sanger, but also Bristol, King's College London, Leicester, BGI, EBR in Kingston, Oxford, McGill University in Canada. And this is a photo from one of the meetings. So this is my boss, Nicole Soranzo, and that's Richard Durbin, the chair of the PI of the whole project. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Sorry, it took a bit longer than an hour.
Don't worry. We held you up. Well, that was great fun. Thank you very much. Any further questions?
This must have to do with is it 16th or 17th century that Scots migrated into Northern Ireland, and then because they were Protestant and the Northern Ireland are Catholic, so I guess they didn't mix much. And I guess this is why you see this. And otherwise, yeah, I guess neighboring counties is sort of probably more southwest than Wales. Neighboring counties will be a bit more related than noticed ones.
I'm just curious. Apparently, if you use the geological breadth of the regions, which is also the variation, I wonder whether things like ancestry bumpy markets could be alternative.
A few people work at the moment at the age of, for example, Doubletons, how old they are within the UK. I mean, I have to say, within the UK, these are very subtle. This is sort of, it's exaggerated because I've colored it in that way, but it's, you have...
There's a reason I ask, have you analyzed the incorrect data? And we got latitude, longitude as well. Only thing actually we did was just somebody, I can't remember, from Spain or Italy, he did around 1,000 SNPs. So they are more indicative of where.
I've seen principal components plots where you really can generate the map of Europe very nicely.
The other thing I'm curious is that I know that both groups are very competitive. Bigo and Impute. So from your experience, which way?
Abigo and Impute. Ah.
Okay. Same as me. Yeah.
Well, Impute seemed to be more accurate, but it choked on our data. So for the last release, we couldn't use Impute because it was just too many samples. So we had to use Beagle. But then later on, one of my colleagues, he worked on imputation, and he found that after using ShapeIt, which is another phasing, that increased the accuracy again. So, at the moment I would say Impute does maybe a better job, but Beagle is sort of more robust to run. But then if you're interested just in phasing, then ShapeIt does a very good job.
From the very earlier on Sanger sequencing technology to today's digital PCR and stuff like that, is the NHS 1,100 samples, is it an easier job compared to what you think that you're working with the Sanger?
The 100,000 samples for the HNS, this will be hard, I'm sure. But, the sequence technologies do improve, and the sequences will get longer, and then I think it won't be so bad. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Given what you've got from these 10,000, do you think that investing in 100,000 is a good use of money?
Well, I think this
are
is...
Are they going to find it?
Yeah, well, I think this is planned for diseases, for specific diseases. And, I mean, cancer, for example, I mean, the genome is completely scrambled up. It depends. I mean,
they're just going on a fishing expedition. Did they actually expect? You know, what's the confidence they will find something in that 100 things?
Well, I mean, this was meant to be sort of the healthy population, the cohorts, and if there is any disease that's genetic,
right.
And it can be compared against. Yeah, these are the healthy people.
So
yeah, that's right. I mean, we're still looking for different phenotype correlations, but these are not diseases.
You don't expect quite much signal.
No, that's right. Yeah. But the exome part, these were disease samples, so they were looking for. But they were just looking in the exome and not genome wide.
The larger factor of that is technological ability. The science, basic science, is still the sequence. No additional theory or anything like that is helpful, but technology will help more in sequencing this.
Mm.
I guess.
Mm.
Do the exome sites get added to as we understand the genome better, or do we now know where all the exome sites are going to be?
There are still improvements. There are still. So you get still sort of new releases with small changes.
So there's still the potential of adding to those sites of interest.
Yes, or combining, or removing. So there are still small changes in terms of gene annotation. And also there will be, I just heard an announcement, there will be a new reference genome. That also is updated every so often, and the new one will include more of the variation part as well, and plug in missing. There's still missing bits, especially around the centromere, which is very repetitive. But these are small changes compared to from between 2000 and 2003.
Thank you again very much indeed.
Thank you for listening.